Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 91-year-old Ed Larson of Santa Cruz, California, originally from Seattle, Washington. If you grew up in Sacramento, perhaps he was your art teacher, and he's helping teach a lot of folks about the China-Burma-India theater of World War II through his book, Spear Carrier in a Backwater War. If you'd like to order it, I have a link for you at hometownheroesradio.com. Ed's dream was to be a fighter pilot, but instead he was part of a vital lifeline providing fuel to the fighters, delivering it from India to China by flying over the Himalayas in C-46s, as well as C-109s, which were B-24s converted to carry fuel instead of bombs. Ed, what was it that made what you were doing so dangerous?
We never had any fighter opposition. Our enemy was the weather, and the fact that the terrain was so bad and the radio facilities were so primitive that you're pretty much on your own, so to speak. I mean, when you started out from India to fly to China, you were in bad weather probably most of the way, and we only had dead reckoning navigation. You flew out your time, figuring that what the winds were being reported, and then you let down. And hopefully everything was okay. But if the headwinds were up, you might let down into a mountain somewhere, which happened a lot.
Well, I've talked to some guys who flew that route, and they've told me about the aluminum highway.
Yes.
Why don't you explain to us what that was? It's not very encouraging.
No, it was a place where a lot of aircraft were lost, mainly because of weather. But I give all kinds of credit to the guys that were there at the first, before my time, because they were flying C-47s and B-24s that were really not capable of getting all that much altitude to spare. They were primitive aircraft, the C-47s in particular, and it amounted to a time of cliff dodging. And as a result of that, a lot of airplanes are down there, and a lot of them that I don't think have ever been found. I'm sure of that.
Well, and that's where that term, the aluminum highway, came from, all the wreckage. They said you could even navigate your way across the Himalayas based on the wreckage, which is, I mean, the cost of that in human lives is pricey. With regard to your specific missions there, these C-109s, you're loaded with aviation fuel.
Right.
Now, you said you never faced fighter opposition. Good thing, because, I mean, they could have made you a big old bomb, right?
Oh, yeah. If we'd had any fighter opposition down there at all, we'd have been toast. Because none of the aircraft that we had had any guns or any kind of defense mechanism. Most of the flying I did over there was in C-46 Commandos, which was a huge largest twin-engine aircraft in the world at the time of the war. It was a good airplane. It carried a heavy load. It looked like a big whale. It was an ugly airplane. But with the advent of what they call the R2800 engine, which was a huge Pratt & Whitney engine, we had 4,000 horsepower aircraft there, and we could carry good loads. It was a dependable airplane and pretty forgiving. Most of our flying was from areas, gas drops like Kunming, Yunnanyi, Luoyang, places like that. We would pick up the fuel locally there and then fly it often, always, of course, in C-46s in 50-gallon drums and dump it off at the fighter strips along with the bombs and ammo that we carried. And that's what kept them going.
So when we see the old footage or the still photographs of the P-40s with the shark teeth on the nose,
right,
the flying in China, they wouldn't have been flying without the fuel you brought them.
That's right. Yeah, we kept them aloft. The P-40, of course, was the hallmark aircraft of the CBI because of the fact that it flew there when Chenault was there, and those were early 40s. They were
right. They were long before you got there.
Oh, yeah. But the P-40 lasted till the end of the war. I think the last model was an N model that was quite an airplane. Most of the fighter aircraft over there that were being used were P-51s.
Sure.
Some P-47s, but they used so much fuel that the 51 was therefore more practical.
I want to talk to you about some of the hazards that you faced. You mentioned the weather was your opposition, was your enemy. But while we're on the topic of those fighter planes, when you would deliver this gas over there to China where the fighters are going to be using it, did you ever try to talk your way into a joyride in one of those fighters, with one of those hot pilots?
This is a story that I brought out in the book. There were three abandoned P-40s on the strip at Yunnanyi when we got over there, and we were flying, like I say, the C-46s. Several of us got together and thought, hey, maybe we can get one of these into flyable condition so that, you know, we could get a little P-40 time on our logbooks and say that we at least had flown a fighter. So we tackled one that was particularly in fairly good shape. We had a crew chief that was from a fighter unit that was adjacent to us there at Yunnanyi. He helped us out some and figured that it was practical for us to go ahead. But some of the parts we couldn't get a hold of, and we wanted to get the okay of our CO to let us go ahead with a project which had been kind of under wraps up until that time. So my buddy and I went in and presented our plan to our CO, and he blew his stack. He said, yeah, this is a war zone. You guys are supposed to be flying transports. You're not going to go out and kill yourself in these P-40s, so just forget it. And that's what stopped us there. But it was a near miss. We were getting close to being able to get one started up and get it going.
So if you had decided to ask forgiveness instead of permission, you might have gotten away with it, huh?
Well, if we'd asked forgiveness, we might have busted our necks, too, because within about, 2 months, they did refurbish the old trio of 40s that were there, and they all crashed.
Wow.
Nobody was killed or badly injured, but they just quit, you know, and they ended up in a rice paddy somewhere with a mark on their forehead from hitting a gun sight or something.
So maybe the CO was right and discretion was the better part of valor there.
He was absolutely right.
So on these missions, and maybe I should go right here with the title of your book, Spear Carrier in a Backwater War. What does that mean? Explain how you came up with that title and what it represents.
Okay, yeah. In the legitimate theater, a spear carrier is a person that's in a play that is nothing much more than just a backdrop. It'd be the people in a crowd. It would be someone eating in a restaurant or that didn't have a speaking part, that didn't really have any effect on the outcome of the plot or what happened to the stars. And so the name always stuck with me. Spear Carrier was being kind of not exactly a loser, but a person that really didn't have a very important job to do. So I thought, hey, Spear Carrier in a Backwater War was a fairly logical title, because that's what we were. We were carrying stuff to guys that were flying hot airplanes and enjoying the romance and the adventure of being fighter pilots and out on search and destroy missions.
So all of that seemed real exciting to you, but your view of your own duties and contribution, what you're saying with that title is, oh, it wasn't that important. But the reality is, as I know you recognize, that those guys couldn't do what they were doing without what you guys were doing.
And that's true. And we took a lot of chances. We were landing on fighter strips. We lost two airplanes at a little place called Chikiang, which I should also mention before we're finished. They just ran off the end of the runway because the strip was too short. We flew in bad weather. We flew in rotten field conditions. We flew when we really didn't want to fly. So it wasn't, you know, I don't negate my part in the war, but it wasn't the adventure and zip that most of the pilots that were there enjoyed.
Sure. Well, then I think it's important that he wrote a book like this, because it can help us understand the things we don't hear about all the time. Because everyone's heard about fighter pilots and some of the big battles and prisoners of war and all these things that are so easy to spot and easy to gravitate towards. And it's easy to forget about all the guys who are just doing their job like you were over there.
Yeah, and it's really important that they be remembered. Close to the end of the war, I lost 5 friends in one crash. It was a heavy load for me to carry. I came out of the war with it's a little bit difficult to explain precisely what it was. I guess an ongoing depression and a strong feeling of guilt that I should have been on the flight, which I should have been, but I had been diverted to go do something else. It's easy for me to understand the crisis that some of these young kids are going through now, coming home from Afghanistan and Iraq. And I feel for them. I feel very strongly that they need all the help that they can get to make their recovery, because it's not easy. And I felt that way for several years afterwards. It was a tough thing to break through.
I'm glad you brought that up, because we see and we're so moved by the physical wounds that are so obvious.
Yes.
Guys who lose an eye or an arm or a leg or any kind of physical wound, but the emotional and the mental wounds are significant and lasting and heavy, and that's what you're talking about. I don't want to push you to go anywhere you don't want to go, but can you help us understand what that crash was and why you were supposed to be with them?
Yeah, it was, I don't know what the main cause of the crash was. I've never been able to understand that. But I had been assigned to fly with one pilot who had requested me as the co-pilot. I was flying co-pilot at the time. The flight roster just came up that I was assigned to a flight going out to Shanghai just after the war was over. And this crash happened after the war was over. Mm. Anyhow, we flew out to Shanghai, dropped a load of stuff off, then came back to our base. It was close to where we are. We were flying out at Luoyang at the time, and this was a place called Kunming. We were about ready to take off from Kunming and fly back to Luoyang when we were told to stand by because they had another assignment for us. We waited and waited, and finally we were told that we were to fly a load of Chinese generals from Kunming to a fighter strip called Chikiang. This was a primary assembly of Japanese and Chinese leaders to establish the primary factors that would govern the surrender of Japan and China. So we loaded these generals up in the 46 and flew to Chikiang. Got in there fairly early and realized finally that, hey, this was a big show. We were a bunch of, as I say, you know, mud cake guys that were from the backwater war. And here we were going to be dropped down at the ceremony that dictated the surrender of Japan to China. It was really exciting. We flew in there at 10:30 in the morning, and the meeting was to be in the afternoon. About, I guess, 1 o'clock in the afternoon, we heard this strange engine noise coming over the hills from the east, and it was a Betty bomber, which was one of our main concerns as far as the Japanese bomber was concerned. Good airplane. It flew in. It had huge white crosses on it. They landed, bounced a couple of times, which pleased us a great deal, and then taxied up to a hard stand, and about, oh, I guess 8 or 10 guys got out of that airplane and stood around, and everybody was, of course, staring at them, and this was something that, hey, here's the enemy 10 feet from where we were standing. It was close quarters. What they had done was they had taken a bunch of, like, picnic tables and put them out in a line, covered them with sheets to form a kind of a little dignity in this muddy fighter strip for the surrender to take place, because it was all kind of just off the top of their heads. And then following the Betty by about half an hour, a plane that we called Topsy, a twin-engine transport, flew in. It was gorgeous. The camouflage job on the airplane was absolutely beautiful. I likened it to a one of those exotic toads that would have maybe white, red, yellow, green, predominantly dark green. That was the camouflage pattern they used. The airplane landed perfectly, taxied up beside the Betty bomber. Three Japanese top commanders climbed down, complete with their impeccable uniforms, impeccable samurai swords. The airplane absolutely gleamed. Everything about it was clean, perfect. And here it's sitting amongst these C-46s and P-51s that have been operational, and they're all dirty. The wheels are caked with mud and all that. So it stood out. I say in there, she was the star of the show. It was a beautiful airplane anyhow. To make the long story short, they went ahead with the ceremony, and we were privy to be right there at the signing of the papers, etc. To get back to the crash, I had been regularly scheduled to fly with this kid that was flying first pilot, because I had been assigned to take the Shanghai trip and was delayed, I didn't get back in time. And five of my friends, one of whom was a buddy that was involved with me in the P-40 caper that we were going to pull off, they were all killed. And the airplane crashed only about 20 miles from Kunming, which was a pretty decent airport at the time. It had lights and all that. I don't know what happened, but I carried the survivor guilt of that. And I don't, you know, it's easy to say, hey, it wasn't your fault. You shouldn't have been there. You were in Shanghai. You were doing what you were told to do. It's fine to say that. And it's fine probably to say to some of these kids, well, you're going to be fine and all that. You don't get past it.
It doesn't make it better.
It doesn't make it better. And there's times today, 70 years after the fact, that there's still that little grab, maybe in a dream, or that thing wasn't right. That's just the way I feel, and that's what enables me, and I'm very grateful to have some commiseration for these kids that are suffering physically and mentally at this point in time.
And I don't want to rub salt in any of those wounds. I just want to, again, understand it and make sure our listeners understand.
Of course, of course. No, I think you've handled it very gracefully, and I've done the best I could to hang together.
Well, and part of that implication, I mean, these are five guys that you knew that you'd flown with.
Yeah.
You would have been on the plane, and one of the guys was in the position that you would have had. So, in other words, you probably felt like somebody died in your place.
Exactly. That was my feeling, you know, because when you commit to a partnership, you kind of assign a permanence to... there were several guys that I flew with regularly, but this time, it was just this one kid at this particular point in time. There was a closeness there and a feeling that you could depend on one another. He knew what I could do in the right seat. I knew what he could do in the left seat. Oftentimes, we just switched. One was flying pilot, one was flying co-pilot. Survivor's guilt is something that you don't get over in a week. Or a month.
Well, and that was my question, and you made it clear that it did weigh on you for quite a while affected your life after you got back from the war.
Oh, desperately, yeah. Definitely.
Was there something that eventually did help you deal with it or move past it in a way?
Yeah, I'm sure there was. It was the fact that time passed, that I began to move a little bit away from the immediate remembrance of what had happened. The flight log was a little bit hazier, and time had made things, it was like putting a little bit of salve on a wound. And then I married, and my wife knew how I felt, and a wonderful, incredible woman that I lived with for 63 years that understood the problem and helped me through it.
And you'll find a photo of Marilyn in her World War II Waves uniform in Ed's book, which he dedicated to her. All that information is at hometownheroesradio.com. When we come back, how something Ed wore in World War II saw action in a more recent war, and the adventure he had just in the last year that he calls one of the best experiences of his life. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.